Good morning. The death of an Ohio teen from an amoeba-caused brain infection is a cautionary tale for travelers to any freshwater area. State epidemiologist Sarah Park has a list of precautions. And what's it like to be a conservative academic in a profession where liberals are the huge majority? That question is the basis for research reviewed by contributing editor Neil Milner in this week's Long View. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Genius can be a curse as well as a blessing, and both sides are in play in the Pulitzer Prize-winning drama Proof, which all the world's a stage theater company is bringing to town. And you've probably walked by it 100 times without wondering how all those paintings got there. The backstory of Art on the Zoo Fence.
That's the conversation for Wednesday, June 29th. It all starts after this news. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Your opening story made me think about George Orwell's Thought Police.
Well, and after last fall, we had a lot of conversations about that.
You bet.
You'll see what that means in just a minute. Now, at the nexus of young adulthood and college, there is a lot of liberal thought. In part, that's because conservative academics in liberal arts schools are a small minority, less than 20%. It can be difficult to function with liberal peers and students, as again we remember from last fall's campus demonstrations and confrontations. According to a recently published book by two political and, yes, conservative scientists, it isn't easy to be a conservative academic. Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now with a look at passing on the right. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Looking at this book and some of what it says about conservatives, it almost sounds like, you know, we have, you know, people in the closet here.
Well, it does. The good news for conservatives is that even though they're in the minority, and this is based on, by the way, Shields and Dunn interviewed 154 conservative academics in 84 schools. That's a lot. What they find is that conservatives are definitely in the minority in the liberal arts part of academia, and that it's just really small. But what they also found out is that the things that other conservative critics also often criticize universities for discriminating overtly against conservatives and for liberals brainwashing, turns out not to be the case. And conservatives who are in the minority generally think that they're treated okay. And some of them even like being in the minority because they can be like Jerry Seinfeld. They can describe the absurdities of other things. But there are other kinds of issues that are significantly problems for the conservatives.
And we'll get to those. But it also seems that a lot of conservatives who are in liberal arts academia make an effort not necessarily to self-reveal, that in fact they tend to assimilate or they tend to evade. Very few are in the combative mode.
Well, that's right. And that's where the term passing on the right, the title is really a nice pun, because what Shields and Dunn say is that a lot of conservative academics behave in their profession the way gay people behaved before it got a little bit easier to come out and be gay. That is, they closet themselves. They don't feel overtly discriminated against, but they're in part of a profession where the dominant feeling is that conservatives can't be intellectuals, and that the kind of progressive agenda has become seen as conventional wisdom. So one of the things that they do is they first of all, since they're so lonely and in a minority, they carefully look for others like them and ask certain questions to see if they share things.
And are there signs and wonders that you're talking
well,
about?
Well, they're not signs and wonders. While signs, I mean, part of these folks are, in fact, religious conservatives, although many of them are not. But what they're looking for are the same kinds of signs that you look for, let's say, when you're a closeted gay person and are looking for friends, looking for others like you. And so they do that sort of thing. They develop their own kind of networks. One of the guys described it, it's sort of like being gay in Mississippi in the 1950s. Essentially, you're reaching out for others like you. Even if you're not overtly discriminated against, you feel like you're not sufficiently part of the culture. And that's pretty much where the book ends, but then something else has happened since the book has come out.
Right. We should say this was written in the pre-Trump era.
This was written in the – there was researched in the pre-Trump era. It was researched a couple of years ago, probably. They finished up the research. And when I went back to look at the book in light of what's going on, I thought, hey, there's a whole other issue here that frankly would drive the conservative academics nuts now, and it's not liberals.
What is it?
What is it? Well, two words. It's Donald Trump. And four words, it's, what is it, the right-wing populism, three words, I guess. And the reason is this. When they talk to all of these conservatives, even though there is some significant differences between libertarians and religious conservatives and others, one of the things that they find that conservative academics share in their belief is the issue of prudence. That they very much distrust passionate politics. They very much distrust big promises. They very much distrust populism.
Well, you just sort of described Donald Trump.
Yes, I did. And I described a lot of other things around. Many of these guys never vote, or people, there are some women in there, because they never can find candidates. But what Donald Trump presents to them and what right-wing populism presents to them is their biggest fear in lots of ways. So it's going to be very and this kind of conservatism that they manifest, this concern with the passion of factions, this concern about people dismissing the roles of institutions that institutions play, this concern that there's too much anger and not enough thinking and there's too much irrationality, that's been a kind of thread of conservatism for a long time, but it may be getting lost in this battle with right-wing populism.
So how are conservative academics going to be able to be who they really are and be able to profess their own beliefs as a matter of academic thought?
Well, the academic thought, see, ironically here, the academic thought is less of a problem than the kind of public thought. If you're an academic, I mean, you know, I come from the wonderful and wacky world of academics, and I understand the really good part. And the good part is that even though the conservatives have this kind of minority status, life can be pretty good for them as long as they're inside academia. The real question is, how are these ideas, which are not just their ideas, but reflect a kind of old thread in conservatism, going to come out in this ultimate battle over the soul of conservatism, which is going to be fought, first of all, the soul of the Republican Party, whether Donald Trump wins or not. And it's going to be very interesting because this kind of notion that moderation and prudence is important has really taken a minority status compared to two things. One is Trump's populism, and the other is this kind of unfettered belief in wealth, that kind of uncritical look at capitalism. And those have been the two dominant views. And in a culture now where there's so much emphasis on individualism, on anger, and so on, this fight for keeping this sort of traditional conservatism may really be more threatened than anything else. So these people may become less relevant in the public sphere, these academics, and their life in the private, in their own professional sphere may still be about the same.
That doesn't seem to do very much for the overall general enrichment of the narrative.
Which narrative?
Well, the narrative that says that we value different opinions, that we value diversity. I mean, we say these things,
yes, yes,
but we really don't seem to value those things.
Well, there are two things going on here. The book, which is pre-Trump, addresses the value of diversity in academia and has a pretty sophisticated argument for the limits of academia right now. It isn't that they distrust that liberals necessarily distrust the conservative thought. It isn't even part of their agenda. They don't think about it. So that's the kind of limits of the narrative there. And you can make a diversity argument, and ironically, they use John Haidt a lot of times to talk about how hard that is. But here we're talking about what you might call public intellectuals, where from my standpoint, this kind of traditional conservatism in the battle for where conservatism is going to go is more threatened outside, that is outside academia, than it is inside, where inside you do have this kind of protection, even though you may be in the minority.
Lots more fragmenting.
Lots more limits on the power of ideas.
And the ability to discuss them.
And the ability openly. To discuss them. That's right.
All right. We got to leave it there in the interest of time. You're going away for a couple of weeks.
I'm going away for a couple of weeks.
We'll see you on the 20th.
Okay.
Thanks for being here.
Sure.
Political scientist Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15, and coming up, a play about the pain that ensues when a noble mind is overthrown. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a remarkable and very rare insect. It's a native species that's found in only one place, the summit of Mauna Kea. It's made a number of adaptations to life at 12,000 feet. Although it's classified as a lugiad, or seed bug, it's actually a carnivore, devouring the bodies of other insects that the wind has blown to the top of the mountain to die. These bugs can't survive the cold temperatures at the summit, but the bug we're thinking of this morning can. It has what scientists describe as antifreeze in its blood. It's usually found at the edge of a snowmelt, feeding on the hundreds of dead insects that can be found in snowpacks in high elevations. It's flightless and highly specialized, and scientists have come to look at it as a kind of bellwether species whose declining numbers signal degradation of the environment. It's about a quarter inch long with long, thin legs. Young bugs are dark brown with red abdomens, while adult bugs are more uniformly dark to black. Its Latin name is Nicias wekiuicola, and today we're looking for the name by which it's commonly known. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the HPR t-shirt.
There's something disturbing to us about extraordinary mental capacity. Not too many centuries ago, the ability to see things others could not was seen as witchcraft and duly punished. We still don't know quite what to do with genius or its close cousin, madness. David Auburn's play Proof looks at the life of a mathematics genius, its decline and its aftermath, from the perspective of a daughter who is haunted by his legacy. Paul Mitri is performing in the All the World's a Stage Theater Company production of the play, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You have the very difficult task of playing not just a genius, but a genius in his prime and in his decline, right?
Yeah, I'm in three of the scenes, and one of them is not to give anything away, but is more of the daughter's fantasy or kind of dream of her father. Mm-hmm. And then two other scenes where you see him in a lucid state, and then you see him kind of at the moment of a big break, where the decline really starts.
And in all that, there's, you know, what is externalized about that internal conflict, right? That's your mm-hmm. challenge.
Yeah, I think in creating the character, I'm drawing a lot on personal experience. Mm-hmm. My father recently died from dementia, and so for me, this is a real labor of love. It's in a way, it's a tribute to him. It's a way for me as an actor to try to come to some understanding of him and what he was going through by trying to live it.
It's a very cruel disease to try to understand, to endure, but also to witness, isn't it?
It is. And I think in this story, it's especially touching to see how the daughter, how Catherine, took care of her father for 5 years, basically gave up her own life, and now she's haunted by how much of his instability she also inherited, not just the genius part and the mathematics part, but did she also get the sickness?
Which really taps into a really universal kind of thing about parents and children and what's nature and what's nurture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all have qualities we'd like to inherit and qualities we wouldn't so much like to inherit, right? And to what degree are we boxed in by genetics?
Mm-hmm. And in this one too, you know, the father is like, of course, would love for her to carry on in his wake, and he has another daughter too. And there's a line in it where he says, you know, Claire did well. I'm satisfied with her. I'm proud of you. And it's that sibling rivalry then.
Boy,
that just comes from. So I know it kills me every time I say it.
That could cut like a knife.
Oh, and I just see, you know, all of us in the room that, you know, when that line comes up, everybody just goes, oh, ouch.
Yeah. And it wasn't meant to hurt either.
No. In his mind, he's, you know, that's just what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's math. It's black and white.
Well, it's kind of like saying to two sisters, you're the pretty one, you're the smart one, or whatever. And everyone has had some version of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this one, in this play too, that kind of sibling rivalry really, really shows up. And again, it's the older sister not trying to be mean. She's really trying to take care of the younger sister.
Yeah.
She's paid the bills. She's sacrificed in her own way. But it was the younger sister who ended up taking care of the father and living with him for 5 years.
And it's the younger sister who has the, quote, talent, such, you know, whatever that means, right?
Yeah. Again, in the play, the older sister, Claire, played by Hannah Shower-Galley, says, you know, I inherited maybe a thousandth of my father's, you know, ability. And that makes me, I'm able to be a currency analyst, and I'm really, really good at it. Catherine, the younger sister, inherited more. I don't know how much more. And that's where we don't know. The whole play kind of goes on. Who wrote this amazing mathematical proof? And who's? How do you prove who wrote that?
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story.
And each one of the characters has varying degrees of self-knowledge mm-hmm. at various stages in their own life. So that's a... Each of the actors faces that challenge to one degree or another, yeah?
Yeah. We've kind of picked a theme in terms of what is reality, you know? And so each of the characters are trying to figure out their own reality and how that reflects to especially Catherine's reality. How do we view her? It's really through our own eyes and our own experience, and we maybe are not able to see something that's right in front of us, and we really should be able to see this. But no, we color it with our own limitations.
In most productions, these lofty questions would be solved to some degree by the director coming in and saying, this is my vision, right? This is how it is.
Yeah.
You have chosen, you folks collectively have chosen not to do that.
Yeah, we've coined the term collaboracting. So all four of us together, plus Andy Lee, our stage manager, we look at ourselves as a true ensemble. And so obviously one of the traps of that way of working as a collaborative ensemble is if ego gets in the way, if you feel like you're not able to actually be honest with each other.
Yeah.
And we recognize that, and we're just very upfront about it. And if anybody comes in to kind of watch and give us some notes, we first thing we say is there are no egos in the room. So please, you know, give us whatever. I'm working with two of my students, Alex Monroe, Rachel Ueno, and I tell them, please give me notes. You know, it isn't just me trying to tell you something. I need the feedback as well.
You know, isn't that kind of a return to the origins of theater? I mean, isn't the director a relatively late phenomenon in theater?
Yeah, I think that, you know, just like Shakespeare as an actor, as a playwright, and as probably the director of it, he had to depend on everybody just doing their job. And I think that is really what collaboration is. It's just do your job, you know. We all know what is demanded of us. And actors, unfortunately, can be incredibly lazy. and I say that as one. So, you know, we have to own up to it. We know what is expected of us. So we have to bring our A game every day to rehearsal.
It's got to be a really good theatrical experience, Paul. It
has been a lot of fun. I mean, it's always a lot of work. And with all the world, we try to work very quickly, too. I want to give the actors what a real professional timeline is, which is you have about 2, maybe 3 weeks to do it in. We don't have 6 weeks. And so you got to work incredibly quickly. But within that, you can still have fun.
Oh, I bet you do. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you.
Paul Mitri is the chair of the Department of Theater and Dance at UH-Manoa and the head of the acting program, as well as artistic director of All the World's a Stage. He plays Robert in the production of Proof that will be offered the next 2 weekends at Chaminade University's Lou Theater.
Elected first term, re-elected second term, Nobel Peace Prize, examining Obama's legacy of abject failure.
The fact that there's so much identity politics surrounding this president is a harbinger of things to come.
From the bailouts to Mr. Beck to the birthers, can the Obama years have really been that bad? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
There's a radio station that tells important stories and tells them well. And these station members know it and believe in Hawaii Public Radio. Thanks to Bradley and Eric Kuo of Honolulu, Sherry Livingston of Kaneohe, and Bobby Varis of Kurdistown. Make sure HPR can continue to tell important stories. You can do that with your membership dollars and reach us at 955-8821 during business hours or donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. A one-stop center to help Micronesians acclimate and access services has gotten both praise and criticism for its efforts. Civil Beat's Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So the center that we're talking about, the Halaula One-Stop Center, seems to have done a lot of good work for a lot of people, and yet there seems to be this idea that it's not just helping folks, but it's also draining what resources we have. That seems to be a familiar refrain.
Right. And as you know, we've reported on Micronesian immigration to the United States quite extensively. And this story builds on that. Let me tell you a little bit about the center first. It's in Kalihi, part of St. Elizabeth's Church there. And it's paid for by Department of Interior funds. Guam has one, too, because, as we have reported, large Micronesian communities, both in Guam and Hawaii. And of course, that's because of COFA, the Compact of Free Associations. So what do the centers do? They help Micronesians really navigate American society, help them sign up for health care, help them get employment advice, language, education, even advice on what to do with landlords at a pretty low cost, only about $500,000 going to the one here locally. But there was a former Peace Corps worker in Micronesia who has complained publicly about the centers. He wrote to both the Honolulu Star-Advertiser as well as the Pacific Daily News in Guam, complaining that these are a waste of taxpayer dollars, that really what you're doing is you're building dependency for Micronesians on U.S. taxpayer money.
Doesn't that really depend on, though, the way in which the centers function and the idea of giving people enough help to start and then slowly releasing them? Wasn't that the whole intention?
I think there's a misunderstanding by a lot of people still that Micronesians come here simply to use American services and feed off us. That is not correct. Certainly there are some people that take advantage of the generous welfare system we have, but many more are contributing to society. The centers themselves are not simply handing out taxpayer dollars to Micronesians. These are people that need help, that don't necessarily speak English. This is a foreign country to them. They've already got family and friends that have moved as well, and the centers are designed to help them get through this transition period and become part of America.
So is there any real threat to the center now?
No, I don't think so. They have funding for a while now, and by 2018, the center locally hopes to be independent on its own. We Are Oceania is the group that's managing it, part of a nonprofit organization. And I think they're here to stay as long as they get support, perhaps from private interest and other governments.
And if Josie Howard, who is the director of We Are Oceania, has her way, that probably will happen.
And Josie has a way of getting her way.
Exactly. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks,
Chad
Bethany.
Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Good morning. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. If you want to be in touch, you can call our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. On Twitter, we're at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR. Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, it's about what happens after you've been accelerated, yeah?
Yeah, Chris. You know, there have been a number of companies, and of course the state as well, have set up these accelerators, and we've talked about it before. Basically, they're places where small startups can get a bump in terms of their, let's say, expertise, connections, maybe some business mentoring, and then they get sort of set off to challenge the world with whatever idea that they have. And, you know, it's a good program because, you know, there's a lot of companies, there's a lot of startup companies kind of going through the accelerator programs. We're going to have a couple of folks from Blue Startups join us on the radio, two companies, one called Unum and another one called MailGap. And we'll talk to them about what the experience is like, what are their companies set up to do, and how do they intend to change the world?
Yeah, because after acceleration comes implementation,
reality.
Right?
What was that?
Implementation.
After acceleration
comes implementation.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, what they say is the devil is in the details, right?
Yeah.
And when it, you know, everybody has a great idea. I mean, you know, you and I both probably have a slew of great ideas. The challenge then is to take that idea and actually bring it to reality, bring it, you know, to the point of making money. What a
yeah.
novel idea.
Oh, it's that's a fairly big canyon to leap over, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's always interesting to you know, hear the dreams of some of the folks that have their startup aspirations and then kind of explore what do they plan to do once they hit the ground running.
Well, let's see what happens, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Aloha. I'm Jason Hoffman from Mensa Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
This month, an Ohio teen water rafting at the U.S. National Whitewater Center near Charlotte, North Carolina, died following a brain infection caused by a freshwater amoeba. Although Hawaii also has freshwater lakes and streams, there are no cases of Naegleria fowleri reported in Hawaii. It's summer travel time, though, and worth a crash course for enjoying freshwater spots without deadly consequences. State epidemiologist Sarah Park is on the phone with us to do that now. Good morning.
Good morning.
When we think about going into the water, I mean, we have had, obviously, we've had some brown water issues when we've had rains and all of that. But in generally, we don't think much about going in the water, enjoying it, getting it up our noses. But that's exactly what has caused this young woman's death and other cases and in other states, 28 of them where this amoeba is found. How do you begin to change people's thinking about how they're going to go off and enjoy a vacation without having it turn deadly?
Yeah, so first of all, I think it's very important to note that this is an extremely rare infection. In the many years that have been it's been monitored by the Centers for Disease Control and Protection nationally, I believe they've only seen about 37 cases since the 1960s. So it just emphasizes it is an extremely rare condition. There can be, this unfortunate one case, but then if you looked into it, there are many, many others who are exposed to the same water but were not infected. And why one person gets infected out of many others who are exposed to the same conditions, it's really unclear. But we do know, as you commented, that this infection, which is an amoeba, it can travel up through the nose up to the brain and cause devastating consequences. And really that's the key, is that, understanding that that's how it's transmitted. It's, and you don't get it from drinking contaminated water. It's purely from getting the water up your nose. And it isn't just any water. It's usually going to be your warm, fresh water lakes or streams, ponds, things like that. You're not going to find it in, say, ocean water. It doesn't survive in seawater or salt water.
What about water that one might use for shampooing your hair or taking a shower?
So normally, that's why we have water standards, clean water standards, and that chlorination will protect us from that, from this amoeba. As long as the water is appropriately treated, it should protect us from that. And so what we're really talking about is fresh water, unfortunately, if water, is not appropriately maintained and chlorinated, that can, potentially put you at risk. These amoeba, the other thing to notice is these amoeba are naturally occurring in the environment. So you can't eradicate it completely from our environment. They're going to be out there. And if you go looking for it, you will find it. And as I said, really the conditions are just to be really aware of, if you're in an area vacationing somewhere on the mainland, especially where there's been, very warm temperatures recently and the waters are noted to be really, really warm, say you're vacationing where there's a lake or a pond, and the water has been noted to be extremely warm, that may be something to keep in mind that could potentially increase the risk. But if you are going to go into the water, the general recommendation has been to use nose clips, try to keep your head above the water, not to douse your head into water, because it's generally speaking, the exposures have been when people have been swimming in the water, diving into the water, or if they're stirring up the sediment at the bottom, and then swimming in that or playing in that, that can put you at risk, because these amoebae sometimes concentrate down at the sediment at the bottom of these freshwater bodies.
At this point, where, obviously we're talking about this because it's hit the news cycle, but you made the point that we've not had huge amounts of cases since the 60s, when, and this has been recorded. But people get scared because there's always the idea of, well, you know, if it happened in this one case, it could happen again. And
sure.
And also that there could be some other mitigating circumstances with the people who were affected. Were there any at all? Were there any common threads among the young people who have died in recent times?
Not that anyone has ever been able to determine. There have been children, there have been adults over the years that have succumbed to this infection. It's unfortunately carries a high fatality rate with it, and that it is deadly. There is a medicine nowadays that potentially can be provided by the CDC, but the key really is recognizing the potential symptoms early on and seeking medical treatment early on. And those symptoms are really of meningitis, so the first stage usually of having headache and even nausea, vomiting, maybe a little fever, but having those, especially the front forehead, very severe headache, and usually within a day to even, usually on average about 5 days after the exposure, but within the week, can be short as a day, can be as long as a week. And if you develop those symptoms after the exposure, you've been diving or swimming or playing in warm, warm, fresh water bodies, and usually we've seen these most commonly in the southern tier states, with warming temperatures, there can be abnormally warm days even in northern states. You can potentially see these cases up there as well. And we have not seen a case here in Hawaii, at least in recent times, as far as I know of. But it is something we keep in mind, and is and as I said, the key is if you understand that within a week of exposure, if you develop these symptoms of severe headache, nausea, vomiting, those kind of things,
get yourself
see a doctor.
To the doctor. Yeah.
It can progress on then to more severe symptoms of stiff neck and confusion, and unfortunately even then coma.
One of the real saving graces that you just talked about is the fact that there is this timeline between when one is exposed and some deadly consequences, and you're asking people to be really vigilant about how they're feeling, and better for them to turn up to the doctor and have it be nothing, or to an ER and have them say, no, it's not that, you've got the flu or something else. Then
right.
For
I
them
mean, it's true
to,
of every infection
not.
Out there. The sooner you recognize there's something, there may be an issue, signs of, that are potentially concerning, and go see a doctor to check it out, to either get the blessing that it's okay or that, potentially we need to do more workup. That's really important. The timing of any infection is always key.
Are there any particular places that the CDC has said to avoid?
No, at this time. This amoeba can be found worldwide in the environment, particularly in warmer climates, particularly in areas where there are fresh bodies of water. We don't have, fortunately, the large bodies of or common bodies of, freshwater lakes and ponds that, say, Florida or other, southern tier states might have. It is something to keep in mind. And again, just to stress that it is an extremely rare condition. There will be any numbers of thousands of people exposed to the same body of water, and they'll be fine. And they may even have gone swimming and diving, but they'll be fine. And yet one person out of these thousands may unfortunately succumb. And why that is, we still don't know.
So it really goes back to two very important things. One, take precautions, as we've talked about, and be really vigilant afterward if you're going to be involved with fresh water and swimming, particularly in warmer climates.
Right.
Okay. Thanks so much for the words of wisdom. We appreciate
that. Sure.
Keep
Thank
everybody
you for
safe.
Having me.
Thanks. Sarah
Bye-bye.
Park is the state epidemiologist and chief of Disease Outbreak Control Division at the Hawaii Department of Health.
This week on Invisibilia, we look at personality.
We are very quiet.
Outspoken.
Introverted. Conscientious.
And this idea we have.
Outgoing.
Hardworking.
Sensitive.
That it explains what happens in our lives.
Loving.
Open.
Tough.
Agreeable.
Is that really the right way to think?
That iconic story is upside down wrong.
That's on the next Invisibilia from NPR.
Tonight at 7.
Good morning, I'm Jackson Button from Dream of a Better World. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we told you about a native insect that can be found in only one place, the summit of Mauna Kea on Hawaii Island. It's a member of a family of bugs that are designed to eat seeds, inserting their straw-like mouth parts into the inner seed tissue and sucking it out. Seeds are scarce at the summit, so these flightless bugs have become predator scavengers, living on the bodies of dead and dying insects that have been blown to high elevations and died from the cold. It's a remarkable example of nature's ability to specialize. The summit of Mauna Kea is an alpine habitat with daily temperature fluctuations between 116 degrees Fahrenheit and 25 degrees Fahrenheit. Virtually no plant life except lichens and moss found among the rocks in a mostly barren environment. These bugs were only discovered in 1980 and are considered a threatened species due to increased human activity at the summit. Vikiu is the Hawaiian word for top or summit. This name was given to Mauna Kea's tallest cinder cone, which reaches 13,796 feet in elevation and is the highest in the Hawaiian archipelago. It's also the name of our mystery guest, the Vikiu bug. And I believe we have a winner.
We did indeed. Nani called us from Wahiwa and is our winner. Kind of got a little bit of a hint there.
Yes, we did.
And we will be sending her an HPR t-shirt. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, we would love to have it. You can always send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And as we always say, you just might hear it on a future show.
It's along the fence of the Honolulu Zoo on Montserrat Avenue, across from the bandstand at Kapi'olani Park, and has become part of any walking tour of Waikiki, the ongoing art exhibit known as Art on the Zoo Fence, Hawaii. Those paintings aren't there by accident. They're part of a tradition that goes back more than 50 years. Lynn Forney is determined to keep it going. She's the president of Art on the Zoo Fence, Hawaii, and she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Lynn.
Hi, good morning.
You know, I do think of this as the kind of thing that you might sort of think has always been there, maybe even take for granted as part of life in Waikiki. But behind it, there's a lot of effort from a lot of people, isn't there?
Yes, that's very true. Actually started in 1953 by Sunao Hironaka, who was an art professor at Chaminade College. He developed it as a place for artists of Hawaii to meet and showcase their art together. It was just a Saturday thing. It became really popular and really grew. And then by the 1970s, there were about 50 permanent artists, a whole bunch of standbys, and a waiting list of about 300. So then a Sunday group was added under the direction of Joe Dawson, who was a really well-known Hawaii artist and an investigator with the Honolulu Police Department. And it's just kind of grown since then, you know, to include all sorts of artists from here in Hawaii.
And in the process, Lynn, I would think that a lot of people who didn't think of themselves as artists who would show their work have sort of grown into that role. Has it been like that?
Yeah, we get artists down there that are really new to art and have no idea about how to show their art or how to approach customers or anything. They really learn a lot while they're down there. And, of course, there have been some artists who have gone on to become pretty famous, including David Lee, Dana Queen, who was even not too long ago down there at the fence visiting with us, Tabora, Hiroshi Tagami, Gary Reed, Peter Hayward, and a few others. So there's been a really nice collection down there. And I believe that some of Hawaii's best artists right now are down there, too.
How does an artist become one of you?
It's actually a very simple process. All we ask is, of course, by law, you need to have a Hawaii General Excise Tax license in order to sell anything in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. You have to bring that down with you. We ask that your paintings or prints be basically just framed, matted, or gallery wrapped. And we do allow photography as well. We have a few really basic rules to follow, but for the most part, that's just it. Have your GE license and have everything framed, matted, or gallery wrapped. Our fee to be down there each day is only $10 because we want to support the arts, we want to support local artists, and we want people to be able to afford their art supplies and show their art to the world.
How many artists do you have on a given day?
Right now, we average anywhere from 15 to 20 artists each Saturday and Sunday. They kind of vary. You know, sometimes we have some on Saturday and some on Sunday, and some do both days. So it just depends on which day it is and how many people show up, and, of course, what the weather's like, too.
No, that's a good point, especially for watercolors, right?
Yes.
And do you still have a waiting list?
No, we do not. We don't have a waiting list right now. We do have some spaces available, just a few spaces available for permanent artists. And, of course, we always have plenty of room for artists to come down and set up what we call puka boards, where they can just display off to the sides of the fence as well. Some artists prefer to do that. We have a few that do that now. But we have plenty of space for standbys to come in if they want. And our permit allows us to go pretty far down Montserrat Avenue.
And do you still have artists doing their thing right there on the fence?
Oh, yes, we do. We have artists that paint. Any given day, you can come by and see a different artist painting. It just depends on who feels like working down there. That's one of the really great things about Art on the Zoo Fence, is that when you go down there, you're going to actually meet the artist themselves or the photographer themselves that's doing the work. They're selling their own work, and they're going to speak with you. So it's a really wonderful experience to meet them and have that face-to-face conversation.
How did you get in on all this?
Actually, my husband is an artist, and we returned to Hawaii about 12 years ago, and we knew of Art on the Zoo Fence from years back growing up here in Hawaii. And we went back, and he started showing his art, and I was just asked by the person who was pretty much running it at the time if I would take over for her. And I agreed to do so. I think everybody should always be willing to do something for someone else that you don't really get anything in return other than just the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping other people.
Which is actually getting quite a lot in return.
Yes, actually it is. And I really do enjoy it, too. I love the arts, and I love promoting the arts. And it's really a lot of fun to watch people put their art up and to look at all the different beautiful artwork that's down there. And I've watched artists grow, too. I've seen them really progress as the years have gone by. Their art's gotten better. They've gotten better. Their sales have gotten better. So it's very fulfilling to see all of that.
Because one of the things about painting is that unless you become part of a community like this, it's not necessarily collaborative. And sometimes collaboration can teach you a lot, can't it?
Yes, because we certainly help each other out. You know, especially if someone new comes down, they may come down and they don't know how to hang their things, you know, so everybody chips in to give them hooks to hang their art up or to help them, or they'll come down and they'll forget their chair, so someone will give them a chair to sit on, you know, just simple things like that, but then encouraging each other with their artwork as well, you know, sharing paints, paintbrushes, whatever they have to do. And, you know, we've made lifelong friends down there as well with the artists. Everybody cares about each other. And we've made lifelong friends with customers as well that have come from all over the world.
So you do have your regulars who maybe say, I came here last year and we came again, that kind of thing?
Oh, yes, definitely. Most of the artists do. They have people that come every year to see them, buy another piece from them. And we've even had people that don't necessarily buy art but still come back every year. You know, they come from wherever, way on the East Coast, and they just come to Hawaii every year because they love Hawaii so much. And they'll come by and visit and just say hello. And we love to see those people as well.
You know, that you really paint a very, pardon the expression, paint a very nice picture of what you've got going on there.
It's a wonderful thing. It really, really is. And it's just so nice for the public to be there and experience it and, you know, walk down the fence. It's a beautiful setting. We're right there on the zoo fence, and it's shaded by those big, beautiful trees on Montserrat. And sometimes there's something over in the park, and there's music playing. So it's always really, really a wonderful experience.
Sounds that way. Thanks very much, Lynn.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for talking with us.
Sure. Lynn Forney is the president of Art on the Zoo Fence, Hawaii. The work is on display every Saturday and Sunday on Montserrat Avenue, across from Kapi'olani Park in Honolulu.
I would say that there's something here for everyone. I mean, I really do think so. Even for people who are sports or athletic, I mean, there's news here, there's information here. So I think a lot of people are like, what is that? And it's only for people that like classical music. That's just not been my experience. While I do enjoy classical music, there's so much more here.
Member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Markets, the theory goes, play no favorites. Theories, however, are just that.
The system's rigged, and it's to my benefit. I don't think that's a good thing, but it is.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Americans feeling not so great about the economy. The Marketplace Edison Research Poll, next time on the program.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Beth Ann, there's a real concern about people's ability to express themselves freely on today's college campuses. Your opening conversation with Neil Milner alluded to that.
Well, and especially if you are a conservative academic, perhaps masquerading as a liberal or just evading it entirely. Very few come out, and sometimes when they do, it's a little combative. But even so, the idea that we can't have open dialogue seems to be very troubling to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, it's got to be troubling, and the irony of it happening on college campuses is too much to even contemplate.
And certainly not lost on you.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. We're going to come back with you tomorrow morning and talk about a program that may be benefiting homeless people by providing things that they might normally have at home, but in a mobile location.
And we'll be taking a photo tour of Oahu, the underappreciated isle. We'd like to hear from you, so call us on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can always find more information about the show and bits and pieces of it and its entire shows past and this one in just a little while on our webpage, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.